Welcome back, my fellow peanuts, and welcome to anyone who is new to my channel or to this podcast. Now, this podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic and violent content. Listener discretion has been advised. Now, welcome back, everybody. I hope everything is returning to your norm, back at work, and all that jazz. I've just returned back to work after a few weeks off, which was always really nice. Good to be refreshed and have a nice recharge for the new year. Today's podcast is about California. This state is really near and dear to my heart. My dad lived in California for most of my teenage years, as well as my 20s and some of my 30s. Now, I was lucky enough to also work there, so I still consider this my second home. Now, our serial killer that we're going to be talking about today is Lonnie Franklin Jr. Now, he was also known as the Grim Sleeper, a nickname that would come after he'd stopped killing for a period of about 14 years. But the police still don't believe necessarily that he has stopped, and the nickname would come from a reporter by the name of Christine. Now, I think I'm saying this correctly. It's Polesque. And I've read the original article, which was amazing, by the way. It's called The Sex Murder Files. If you want to go down a rabbit hole of information about the Grim Sleeper, she's really done her research on Lonnie. And a fun fact, or not really so much a fun fact again, guys, but during these murders, the press had dubbed the killer the South Side Slayer. But these murders during this period of time, they would be not committed by just one person. There'd be a collection of serial killers active in Los Angeles at this time, and one of them is actually about a serial killer that we've already discussed on my podcast, Daniel Lee Siebert. Now, I did briefly mention in that podcast also about him being taking credit for the murders of one of the South Side Slayers, but there were certainly more than just Daniel Lee Siebert at that time. Now, let's get back to Lonnie. So, David Franklin Jr. was born on August 30th, 1952, to Ruby and Lonnie Franklin Sr. Now, he was the second born out of three children. Now, I'm unable to find out who was older and who was younger, but he did have a brother by the name of Otis and a sister by the name of Patricia. Now, Lonnie Sr. was a longshoreman, and Ruby was a former beauty school student from Texas. During his school years, he would experience academic and social and disciplinary problems. Now, this is all I've been able to find out about Lonnie's childhood. When I say I couldn't find much, this is extremely limited on what I could find this time. This is the first time, honestly, that I've not been able to get anything in regards to the childhood. The only really thing that I could find is that he grew up in South Central and the information that I've just provided to you guys. So, really limited. So, I couldn't tell you this time around where he got this need to kill from. But when Lonnie completed high school, he wouldn't go to college. He would join the US Army. However, during this time, he would be stationed in Stuttgart, West Germany, at the Kelly Barracks. And he and two of his colleagues, they would gang rape a 17-year-old girl who just happened to be walking home to, or sorry, walking back from her boyfriend's house to the train station. Now, I have been able to find out her name, and it was Ingrid. And the three men were all stationed at the same barracks, and they would actually off they would sorry they would ask her for directions and offer her a lift home. It would absolutely turn into Ingrid's worst nightmare, though. She would be taken to a remote location. She'd be held at knife point, where they would take turns in raping her. Now, one of them, I think it's Lonnie, given what's coming in the future, would take photos of her during this incident. So after this horrible ordeal that she went through, they'd offer her a ride home. Now, when she was dropped off, Ingrid would manage to convince Lonnie to give her his number to organize to see him again. Now, I can't imagine, after the ordeal that you've just been put through, that you had the smarts to go, you know what? I'm going to get his number so that I can give that information to the police or whomever I really needed to give that information to. But she's a really, really smart girl. And that's, to me, just really incredibly brave. Like, what a incredibly brave young 17-year-old girl. Now, she would end up going to the hospital and she'd report the rape to the police. Now, with the help of the police, she would organize a catch up with Lonnie. Once she arrived at the train station, she was told to drop a hanky as a sign to the police that that was the man they were after, and he would be arrested at this stage. He was a private in the army at this time. The charges would include the rape and kidnapping of Ingrid, as well as the attempted kidnapping of another 18-year-old girl. Now, this girl screamed so much that her neighbors were alerted and the police were called. Thankfully, she didn't meet the same fate as Ingrid. But after an 80-day trial, which Ingrid was able to testify, he would be convicted and sentenced to 3 years and 4 months. And the two other men, they would receive 4 years. It's not clear, or it's not been made clear to me as to why Lonnie got less time, and he would serve less than a year before receiving a general discharge from the US Army. The two other men served out their whole 4 years of their sentence, and it's nowhere reported as to why Lonnie was allowed to serve only that amount of time. Now, I don't know what that would entail, but my sort of mindset is that maybe he was talking about other convicts and he got given a really good deal as a result of this. But I'm not really sure why his two other colleagues would have to serve out 4 years when he would only have to serve out less than a year. So for me, it just seems like either a really good deal was made or something else was going on. Lonnie would marry a Belize woman. She was named Sylvia, and they would have two children, a boy by the name of Christopher. Remember this name, guys, because it's going to come up later in the podcast. And a daughter who's managed to actually keep her name out of the spotlight. Now, Sylvia was loyal and really, really devoted to her faith. She would attend church every week. She would actually have no idea of what Lonnie was doing throughout most of their marriage. And she would even be still married to him at the time that he was arrested. Now, she would visit him in prison, but this would stop after his conviction. Now, I'm guessing that Sylvia thought he was possibly innocent up until the point where he was convicted, or she was just such a loyal wife that she thought that it was the right thing to do to stay with her man and, support him through this. I don't really know. There's not a lot of information about Sylvia because she certainly, after he'd been convicted, really fell off the face of the earth. So it's really hard to sort of find out that information when there's not a lot reported. Now, the first known murder is said to have happened in 1985. Though I do suspect there would have been some criminal activity before this. A man doesn't go from 0 to 100 on his first murder. I suspect that the rape of Ingrid started Lonnie down on this pathway of brutally raping and killing women. But it also seems like, and you'll find this out, by the way, guys, later in the podcast, but he really enjoyed taking photos of his victims. And given what I've read about serial killers and all my research into my podcast, I do suspect that he probably started out stalking and maybe raping women before escalating to murder. And given the times that we're about to be discussing and the victims, or his chosen victims, I should say, it might not have ever been reported, the rapes and possibly stalking. I'm just not sure. Now, I'd like to set the scene as I think this will give you a little bit of perspective as to why it took so long to capture Lonnie. Now, please remember that these are not my thoughts or opinions whatsoever. Rather, what I've been able to find out about the times in which these murders occurred. No one really knew specifically when he started murdering. He's just known on his first victim, right? So we can't really be sure. But what I can be sure of is when he was murdering these victims, they were considered NHI. And I'm repulsed to even say this, okay? I am absolutely repulsed. NHI stands for No Humans Involved, and this was a code that the LAPD would be for victims who were sex workers, ex-convicts, and people that they really didn't deem worthy of investigating. Now, this type of attitude of the police, I suspect, is why there were so many victims that were ignored initially and so many victims. It was also the height of the crack epidemic. So many issues with this time, another one happened to be racial stereotypes would play a part. And due to the misconception that serial killers were mainly white and killed only white victims. And we've seen this one again, guys, on a previous podcast. This one's about Henry Lewis Wallace. Police would ignore the murders of African-American women and would not realize that a black man had been targeting and killing them. Look, it always really upsets me when I see this about victims that are blatantly disregarded because of their status in life, the color of their skin. And it's quite a common occurrence, but it's still upsetting nonetheless. And I'm really noticing it specifically in the African-American community and the Latino community. It's just one of those things that just, you're just not, it's just not cool. Like, and that's the only way I can probably describe it. It's just not cool. Now, we are going to talk about the victims that Lonnie's been convicted of first. Later in the podcast, I'm actually going to be talking about the other victims that he is suspected of killing, but I wanted to pay homage to the victims that he has been convicted of. Now, his first known victim was Deborah Jackson. She was a waitress and as well as a mum of three. She was 29 years old and she was leaving a friend's home and catching the bus back to her house, which was located in South Central. Deborah, she'd be shot three times in the chest and she'd be covered with carpet when she was found. Her body would be found in August 1985. And initially, the police would assume that her murder was drug-related, given the location of where she was found. Now, up on the screen, you can see where the victims' bodies have been found. Now, once I've finished detailing out the victims that Lonnie's been convicted of, I'll show it again. And this can just give you a perspective of where it all happened and how closely it is together. Now, once more victims would be found, this would create doubt around Deborah's murder. Now, I think, let me be clear, when I say when more victims were found, I'm going to be talking about in the early 2000s. So we're talking in about 15 years' time. So the next victim would be Henrietta Wright. She was 34 years old and she was found in August 1986, almost a year after Deborah's body was found. Henrietta's body was wrapped in a blanket and covered with a mattress. She was barefoot and she would be found in an alley. Now, this is a really common occurrence in his victims. Alleys and wrapped in some way, shape or form. So just remember, you're going to hear a lot of that they were dumped in alleys and that there was, you'll hear it a lot more. She was a single mum. She'd been arrested at some stage for prostitution, not that it really matters, but he did specifically pick these sort of, this type of woman. And this is why Lonnie would pick victims like her, because the police would just deem them NHIs, no humans involved. Now, police would also note that she'd been sexually assaulted. Before the bodies of Deborah and Henrietta had been found, police discovered several women in dumpsters and alleyways. The LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Department, they create a task force in the mid-80s. They'd investigate the murders and they believed that the victims had all been killed by one assailant and they nicknamed this person the Southside Slayer. Now, eventually throughout investigating, the police and the Sheriff's Department would realise that there were actually several killers, serial killers and others that were responsible for these murders. It would also be highlighted that the task force would find it difficult to determine which murders were linked to which murderer. And a separate series would start with Deborah Jackson, and this would be a different method from the other victims that have been found in dumpsters and alleyways. These victims specifically would be shot. those other victims were strangled. It was just a completely different method. Now, Lonnie Jackson's murders, they were called the Strawberry Murders. And on the streets, women who are sex workers, specifically those who trade sex for drugs, they're called strawberries, hence the name of Strawberry Murders. But we got a little bit sidetracked, but I do want to highlight that it's not all the police's fault as to why the victims were not linked and, like, much sooner given. Given the amount of murders happening during the 80s, the crack epidemic, it would have been hard. I'm not blaming it all on the police, but I'm certainly saying they didn't help the situation. Barbara Ware, she would be our next victim. She was found under a pile of trash in an alley also. She was found in January 1987. She would be shot once in the chest, and the police would suspect that she'd been sexually assaulted as well. Barbara was a single mother with a four-year-old daughter, and she was only 23 at the time. So here's a really interesting fact. A 911 call was made by someone reporting seeing a man that had thrown a body out of a van. Now, this was around midnight, and it's a really, really dark alley. Now, I've got some pictures up on the screen. That's the alleyway, and that's the van. So some of the details that the caller was providing were quite odd. He'd give the license number on the van. Now, you can see up on my screen at the moment that it seems like it would be very hard to see at night and that there's a ladder in front of it. So how exactly did this person see the license plate and also the van? It's been suspected that it was either Lonnie or someone who knew him had called 911. The van was dumped after the murder. I've got that up on screen as well, where they found it. Now, was Lonnie trying to admit that what he'd done and getting off on calling the police, or did he just really enjoy the cat and mouse game? It does seem like something that has been done previously. The Zodiac Killer, he certainly enjoyed playing mind games and certainly enjoyed screwing with the police. So many of the victims at this time, they were just off to run an errand. And such was for Benita Sparks. She told her mum that she was just going to go and grab some cigarettes, but she never came home. Now, in April 1987, her body would be found in a rubbish bin. She'd be beaten, strangled, and also shot in the chest. A possible sexual assault as well. That's never been confirmed. And she would be initially listed as Jane Doe 25 until she got identified. Our next victim's Mary Lowe. She was 26. She was working as a receptionist and living at home with her parents. She told her mum she was off to a Halloween party and she'd attend that at the Love Trap Bar. Now, even though it was meant to rain that night, Mary was really happy to walk to and from the party. Her mum would definitely advise her against it, but she'd go anyway. Her body would be found in an alleyway behind some bushes in November 1987. But a neighbour would report seeing her get into a car that was a Pinto and the colouring was reddish-orange. So I've got that up on screen of what that would look like. Now, this same neighbour would also say that the driver was male, young, and African-American. Mary's cause of death was also a shot to the chest. Are we seeing a pattern here yet, guys? It does seem to be a really common thread with Lonnie that he would shoot his victims in the chest. So... but just remember this because his method does change. So just giving you a heads up. On January 30th, 1988, now I don't know quite how to say this, so I do apologise. It's Latricia Jefferson's body was found in another alley with her face covered with a napkin with the words AIDS on it. She'd also been shot. Now, I really want you to remember this, guys, because in a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about another victim. And it just seems like he has a real hatred for prostitutes and sex workers. Just remember. Our next victim, she would be only 18 years old, Alicia Monique Alexander. She'd be heading off to the liquor store or the bottle-o if you live in Australia. Before she left, she would even ask her dad if he wanted anything. This would be the last time, though, that her father would see her. And a few days later, her body would be found in another alley. She'd be naked, shot, and sexually assaulted, with a mattress covering her body. Now, the only known survivor of Lonnie Franklin is Intera Margette Washington. Now, Margette was given to her as a pseudonym or a another name, because the police didn't want her real name being out, because she'd survived. But I would also like to prepare you all and say this is a trigger warning for any of my viewers and listeners, what we're about to discuss. On November 19th, 1988, Intera was doing something completely normal. She was walking to a friend's house so they could walk to a party together. She would spot an orange Pinto with racing stripes. Now, this would remind her of a Hot Wheels car or a toy car. Anyone remember, though, that car from Mary's murder, the one that the neighbor saw? Sounds very familiar, right? Now, she would admire the way the car looked, and Lonnie would be hollering at her, and she couldn't really hear what he was saying and yell back at him, "I know you aren't talking to me like that." He would then pull up next to her and offer her a ride. She would initially decline the ride, and Lonnie would respond in kind and say, that's what's wrong with you black women. People can't be nice to you." Now, she would change her mind and get in the car and tell him her plans. And she was really impressed by the inside of his car and the man inside the car, because he was really clean cut and really nice looking. Now, she would invite him to the party she was attending, and he accepted very willingly and just said he needed to make a quick stop before they headed off. Now, he would say that they were going to his uncle's. Please remember this fact, because it will come up later. And Lonnie would get out of the car, but once he and going and go to his uncle's house. Now, once he got out of the car, once he came back to the car, though, his whole attitude had changed. Gone was the friendly guy that she'd initially met, and he would ask her a really odd question that she really didn't seem to understand. "Why did you dog me out?" She would say also that he called her by another name. Lonnie would then shoot her, and right after this, she tried to get out of the car, and he would threaten to shoot her again. It was around about this time that she would lose consciousness. The next moment when she awoke, lights were flashing, the man was on top of her, and he was taking photos of her while he was raping her. He was doing this with a Polaroid camera. Now, she would be begging for her life. He would refuse and say that if she survived, that she would tell the police and he'd get caught. He'd then push her out of the car while it was still in motion. Now, even though she had a gunshot wound to her chest, she ended up dragging herself to her friend's home. And thankfully, her friend was able to come home from that party and saw her lying there. She would immediately call the police and the ambulance, and she would survive her encounter with Lonnie, or otherwise known as the Grim Sleeper. She would give all of those details to the police, and she'd provide a description of him, which you can actually now see on the screen. And after the bullet was removed, the police would link it to a 25 caliber gun. Now, it would lead the police to believe they were dealing with a serial killer who was killing his victims with this type of gun and sexually assaulting his victims and dumping their bodies. Even though there would be 14 years between the next known victim, the police would have new advantages in their arsenal by the time this next murder happened. Things such as DNA and a cold case department, and a lot more detectives looking into these type of murders. I also don't believe, though, that he wasn't active during this time. It just seems to me that either the victims were never found, or they've possibly been listed as a Jane Doe's, or that it's murders that they just can't connect to him. Someone as violent as Lonnie doesn't just stop, in my opinion. But there is some method to this madness, though, because what if he laid low because of a victim surviving? Now, he would have found out about that in the newspapers, so you do have to wonder whether that was the reason why the murders stopped. But once again, the Grim Sleeper, he would strike again. But his method had changed by the time that this next known victim. Not sure as to why it had, but he would prefer to strangle his victims rather than a gun. It is a lot more personal to strangle someone. You have to look the victim in the eye, you have to be incredibly strong. And it's a real power and control situation when it comes to strangulation. So I'm wondering whether there was more anger because of the fact that he wasn't able to murder as frequently. The next three victims, they're also the ones about his convictions, and there's quite a bit of time between them. At some point in the podcast, we are going to be talking about the victims that he's suspected of killing, just not convicted of. So after his 14-year hiatus, the next victim would be Princess Cheyenne Berthemieu. Now, she'd go missing in December 2001. She would be found in March of 2002. She was nude and in an alleyway, and she would be strangled and hidden in the bushes. The next victim was Valerie McCorvey. Her body was discovered in July 2003. She'd been the victim of strangulation and rape. The police would initially believe that her boyfriend had committed the crime until they were able to match the DNA to Princess's murder and one of the other victims from the 1980s, Mary Lowe. Now, the last known victim is Jensea Peters. Her body was found in January 2007. She was found by a homeless man, and she'd been shot, raped, and strangled and placed in a garbage bag. Now, the DNA would be connected to Lonnie's victims again, and as a result of the last murder, the police chief, he would order a task force to investigate this serial killer. They'd call themselves the 800 Task Force because when they first started all working together, they'd be in a room located, and they'd be in a room 800. The task force would consist of seven detectives, and they were investigating the last three murders, as well as the victims in the 1980s that were all linked by DNA. There was a total of 12 unsolved murders that were all linked by this assailant's DNA. Now, I've spoken about the reporter Christine Palasek, who I mentioned at the start of the podcast. Now, she'd write several articles for LA Weekly on the unsolved murders and the task force's progress. If you'd like to read them, just drop me a comment in the comment section, and I'm more than happy to add the link to this podcast. They're a really, really great read. I got a lot of information and a lot out of it. She's also written a book about Lonnie called The Grim Sleeper, The Lost Women of South Central. I think it's fantastic, personally. So just let me know in the comment section and I'll drop you all those links. Honestly, though, I do think she brought some much needed attention to these murders, which would force the police department to start looking into and trying to solve them. He really did pick victims that no one cared about. And that's not to say, though, that the community didn't, just the people that needed to do something about it, they weren't doing anything about it. And during this time, the police department and the city, they didn't warn the community about these murders or any possible dangers during the 1980s of serial killers or these killers. And even when the task force was formed, this task 800 task force, they'd never inform the victims' families or any progress, like the victims' families have updates or any progress on any of the on any of those cases. This boggles my mind a little bit. Like, you have created a task force about these 12 victims that no one has really cared for, no one has really understood, and you're not going to ring their families and say, hey, we're working on this, and here's our update. We've managed to link the DNA and we're looking into this. And it just, yeah, it's just really disappointing that this was their experience. On July 7th, 2010, it was reported that the suspect of the killings had been identified. Now, this suspect would obviously be Lonnie David Franklin Jr. He'd worked in the 80s for the City of Los Angeles as a garbage collector, or a garbo, as we like to call them in Australia. He'd also work as a mechanic in the police department. Now, the police department, they couldn't find a DNA match in California's criminal database. So they would do a search on similar matches, and they'd even look for familial matches as well. Now, they would soon get a match to Lonnie's son, Christopher. And because Christopher had been convicted of a crime and he had to give his DNA. So they were able to, you know, confirm it that way. But they did have to confirm it was definitely him. So the police department, they would come up with an ingenious plan on how to do this. I actually really enjoyed this, reading about this. One of the detectives would pose as a busboy while Lonnie was at a pizza place. And after he had left, the detective who was posing as the busboy, he'd collect a half-eaten pizza, a fork, two napkins, cups, and a piece of cake. Like, seriously, can never have too much evidence, can you? Now, his DNA would match the samples that they collected at those previous crime scenes. And something else would come to light when they were investigating Lonnie. They'd had a missed opportunity to catch him. He'd been convicted of a crime in 2003. I believe it was related to stealing car parts or something like that. It was just, doesn't really matter. But he was under supervised probation and his DNA was meant to be collected as per Proposition 69. Now, this is where the law states that DNA must be collected for people who are charged and convicted of a crime. Now, unfortunately, during this period of time, the probation department, they lacked the resources to collect DNA and they didn't do it. Now, I imagine it was quite a different time when that particular proposition, so I do understand how these things happen, right? Now, Lonnie would be charged with 10 counts of murder for Deborah Jackson's, for Henrietta Wright, Barbara Ware, Bernita Sparks, Mary Lowe, Patricia Jefferson, Alicia Monique Alexander, Princess Cheyenne, Valerie McCorvey, and Jensia Peters, and one attempted murder in Retta Inetera Margaret Washington. Now, he was held without bail. Now, he wasn't charged with an 11th victim, Thomas Sylvester Steele, an African-American male. We will go through this just at a later time, but you'll hear that name again. In December of the same year, 2010, they were the LAPD, they would release 180 photos of the women that had been found in the home of Lonnie Franklin during the search warrant. Now, I've got pictures that you can see on the screen now of his home and also what had been released to the press in regards to those photos. The police were desperately trying to identify these women because during the search, the police would find over 1,000 photos of women ranging from teenagers to middle-aged women to even older. Now, some of these photos, they would show women conscious and unconscious and just some really, really disturbing photos. These photos would date back over 30 years. The evidence included photos of these victims, the ones that he'd been charged with, as well as the other ones that he hasn't, and hundreds of hours of videos. In November 2011, the police department and prosecution believed that Lonnie was responsible for 6 more murders, 4 bodies that have been found and 2 that have not. Now, we're going to go through those victims now. The possible victims of Lonnie Franklin, aka the Grim Sleeper, he was never convicted of the following murders, but investigators, they do believe he was responsible or in some way, shape or form connected to these victims. Now, Sharon Alicia Dismuke, prosecutors suspected that Sharon was a victim of the Grim Sleeper, and if true, it would have been his first victim. But this has never been proven because Sharon was not considered a victim of Lonnie until after his arrest. Sharon's body was found in January 1984 in an abandoned gas station. She'd been gagged and the same 25 caliber pistol that was used in Jensia Peters' murder was also the one that fatally shot Sharon twice. Now, this gun would be found in Lonnie's bedroom. Now, Thomas Sylvester Steele. Now, Thomas's body was found on the intersection of 71st Street and Halldale Avenue in Harvard Park. Lonnie was never charged in connection to Thomas's murder due to just a lack of evidence, but they believe that Thomas was either one of Lonnie's friends or a pimp, and he discovered the killer's identity, and that's the reason behind his murder. Now, Inez Elizabeth Warren, she was found in August 1988 in an alley. She was alive and immediately rushed to the local hospital. Shortly after arriving, though, at the hospital, she'd pass away. The bullet that killed her was never recovered, but the authorities did state it was a close range that she was shot in the left part of the chest, and the trajectory matching the shots that Lonnie's other victims. She was not considered, though, a victim of Lonnie until after his arrest. Georgina May Thomas, she was found in almost the end of December in the year 2000, just a mile away from where Barbara Ware was found. Now, the shooting had similar attributes to the other murders, and when authorities searched his home, they found the 25 caliber pistol that was later proven to have killed Georgina. She's also a victim that was not considered until after his arrest. Her name is Aaliyah Marshall. Her body has never been found, and she was last seen in February 2005. But her school ID was found in Lonnie's garage. And unfortunately, there was not enough evidence to pursue a conviction in this one. And Rolnia Morris, her body has never been found as well, but she was last seen in September 2005. Her Nevada's driver's license and two sexually explicit photos were found in his garage. Now, they would present evidence of all six victims in his sentence, all these suspected victims, they would actually present this during his sentencing hearing. So that's really interesting. But almost 6 years after his arrest, the Grim Sleeper, he would finally go on trial. The amount of evidence that was found in his home caused a lot, long pre-trial discovery, and numerous delay tactics were done by the defense. The defense had questions about testimonies, about the DNA, about the surviving victim. Just for all their hard work, it would be for nothing, because realistically what would happen is the trial would go ahead. And this would begin in February 2016. The prosecution, they'd show those gruesome photos from the crime scenes, as well as the victim's photos that they found in Lonnie's household. The prosecutor would also show the interrogation, and I'm quoting directly from the trial here, pay close attention to his body language and his conduct during that interview process as he laughs and makes light at the dead women lying on a table in front of him. Now, after reviewing the hundreds of unsolved murders and the missing people, the police would end up making a strategic decision not to seek additional charges, as they were concerned it would cause even more delays to this trial. His rape victim, Ingrid, from Germany, she would fly over and she would testify, and his surviving victim, she would describe her ordeal and what she had been put through and what her recovery process was like. The defense team, to me, they really seem to be grasping at some straws. This one in particular really concerns me. Calling DNA and ballistics an inferior science. They introduced a mystery man with a gun, which really confused me. They would introduce an alternative suspect, saying that it was Lonnie's nephew, and that secretly his nephew had been jealous of him his whole entire life. And they would use the surviving victim's own testimony against her and say that when Lonnie's went to his uncle's house, that it was his nephew that had attacked her. Now, nothing like a good tactic with an alternative suspect, right? That's a really smart play in this. However, it just didn't lay well, like at all. You've got all of these photos, you've got hundreds of hours of videos of victims that have yet to be identified. You can't fight that. You just can't. The trial would end on May 2nd, 2016, and the jury, they would end up deliberating for maybe a day and a half before convicting Lonnie on all counts. So those counts were 10 murder charges and one attempted murder. And the jury would also recommend the death penalty. And after the initial conviction, though, prosecutors presented more evidence against Franklin during the penalty phase of the trial. A woman testified that, so the woman who was raped, Ingrid, and also the alleged almost kidnapped back victim from Germany would testify. Now, this trial, it was just a really bitter back and forth between attorneys, and it would this back and forth would continue specifically during the penalty phase. So before the sentencing, Lonnie's defense team made two last ditch efforts to keep his client off death row. The judge would really quickly shoot down a motion for a new trial based on allegations of prosecution's misconduct, as well as a motion calling for a sentence of life without parole instead of the death penalty. Now, hours after Lonnie's defense attorney released a statement decrying, depicting that the death penalty is a pointless waste of tax dollars, considering the outcomes are often the same since the inmates will almost certainly die from causes other than execution. That's what he would say in a statement. And the only significant difference is the millions of dollars wasted on a death verdict. California's death penalty has been the subject of some really intense legal battles. There are 746 people on California's death row, and no one's been executed since 2006. But on March 28th, 2020, at the age of 67, Lonnie Franklin would be found unresponsive in his prison cell in San Quentin Prison. Now, medical assistance was rendered and an ambulance was summoned, but his cause of death was still pending. However, there were no signs of trauma. And as of June 2023, so last year, the cause of death has not been it's not been publicly released, the results of the autopsy. He's in San Quentin Prison. This is one of the worst prisons ever. Like, it's really well known to be one of the worst prisons. So I couldn't think of anything worse than to be on the death row in that type of prison. Just gonna say. But again, a death that came too quickly and too kindly to someone who has just been a bane on people's existence and just women. The amount of pain he has caused them, you know, it was a really easy death as far as I'm concerned. But considering they haven't released the results, I'm wondering whether there's a little bit behind that, that perhaps there is more to that. Anyway, my wonderful peanuts, thank you all for listening to episode 8. And if you like this podcast, please hit that like button, subscribe, and go and listen to other episodes if you're new to the channel. But I do wish you all a great weekend, my fellow peanuts. Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful one.